You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello and welcome to the very first episode of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture, a new podcast brought to you by Eagles on Pogo Sticks. I'm Matt, and I'm joined by Magga, my good friend and co-blogger. Hi, Magga.
Hi, Matt.
We will be talking about culture, pop culture, films, books, TV series, possibly games, theatre, anything basically that comes into our minds. We hope that you join us for A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. So how's your August been so far? What have you seen many good films? Has there been anything good? Has it been one of those terrible summers where there's just action movies and Michael Bay and nothing else?
Usually I give Mr. Bay some kind of wide berth. I haven't seen a whole lot. I've been a little bit on holiday. Holiday time is not exactly movie time for me. What I've seen is Paul Verhoeven's Elle. I could tell you in 1 minute what I had a problem with, basically, and I didn't like it too much. It has dangerous sexual politics, I find. Verhoeven is not exactly an expert on the female sexual persona, is he? Basic Instinct, for instance, is some kind of weird. With Elle, I had better hopes, because Isabelle Huppert plays the lead, and she has some kind of... She brings a lot of credibility to the role. She is a businesswoman, 50s, divorced with a son, and one night she is assaulted in her home and she is raped. 10 minutes later, she takes a bath and then she orders sushi. It didn't sit with me right from the beginning. Her character is definitely not one to go into some kind of self-help group or into group therapy, not at all. But she denies a lot of it, and then later she tells her friends. And I couldn't understand her, and I sort of couldn't cope, because the rape at the very beginning of the film is shown only by... It's not shown at all, it's during a blackout, you only hear the sounds. And the picture comes on only when it's over. And I thought, oh, okay, maybe Verhoeven is some kind of sensible guy now, and he wants to sort of come at difficult things with more sensibility. No, he shows the rape twice over later in the movie, and that didn't sit right with me either. Either you show the aftermath of a rape, what can happen to someone, and then you leave the rape be. That has happened. But he goes back to it twice or three times, and she even has some kind of weird relationship with the rapist.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, Verhoeven is not the first person I think of when I think of, you know, sensitive handling of these topics. I think there's probably value in making something like this uncomfortable, because, I mean, it should be uncomfortable. But I don't know, I still find Verhoeven tends too much towards the kind of teenage, you know, let's shock people, give people something that makes them go, oh no. I don't know, he's... For my taste, he's too much of a teenager when it comes to these things. So I'm not sure I'll be checking out Elle anytime soon. But then again, Isabelle Huppert, I mean, I think I've never seen her put in an uninteresting performance. I've seen her put in performances where I wasn't sure I wanted to spend time with that person. But I think that is fair. You know, films should be able to do that. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure whether I'll go with the Verhoeven. I'm not sure I have to see this. Or Huppert, I should probably check it out. You know, it's going to be on TV at some point before long.
Yeah,
it's probably pretty much the opposite of my recent pop culture experiences. I went to see War for the Planet of the Apes yesterday. It's not a bad film. I think it's a pretty good film. I like the second one better, though. I find that War for the Planet of the Apes, it's a bit too weary, too tired at the beginning. That fits with the character, the main character of Caesar, but for the first half hour I thought, yeah, if you're so tired of this whole war with humans and apes, then I'm not sure that justifies a film. But I think the film becomes much better later on. Not sure about the very ending, which drifts a bit towards sentimentality and pathos, but it's still... For anyone who liked the first two films, it's definitely a worthy addition, if not a flawless one. But since we're talking about war, perhaps not necessarily with apes and stuff, but I think you brought us something to do with war, right?
Yes, I did. I went to see Dunkirk. I have to start somewhere else. By complete coincidence, we found ourselves in the south of England on a holiday. I didn't plan it. My daughter planned it. My partner planned it. It was a surprise to me. And we went to Dover. And Dover Castle is where the whole Dunkirk headquarters were, the brains of the operation, if you like. And the people there, the ones who guide you through the exhibitions and the tours, they really rather liked it. They're probably not the foremost historical experts, but they deal with Dover and the whole enterprise every day in a way, and they liked it. They said it was, as far as they could tell, it was realistic. There were some dramatic adjustments, as there are in every movie, but they were really in favor of it. Their memory was fresh. They had only seen it a day ago, 2 days ago. It was some kind of special screening. It wasn't even on properly in the UK. So that was when I heard the one of many good criticisms about Dunkirk. So I went to see it. Christopher Nolan, what's not to like? And I have to say, I really, really liked it. I am not the first guy to ask for a war movie, you know me. Two things struck me at the very beginning. I had a look at the IMDb page of Dunkirk, and I realized it's probably Chris Nolan's shortest movie to date. It's only 106 minutes. And I realized why after 20 minutes or so, because he shows us some kind of war procedural. You know, sometimes movie buffs talk about police procedurals. 90 minutes, they find who done it, and that's it. Over. Next. Nolan does something similar with war. He gives us a title card. 400,000 Brits are pressed to the beach from all sides, from the German. There are a few French guys who are also there with them in Dunkirk. What to do? How to bring them home? And that's it. That's the overall arc. Really all Nolan needs to create suspense. And I think if Dunkirk would run the usual length, like 2 hours 15, 2 hours 30, like all those, the Batman movies, or any other Nolan, basically, it would be too long. He wouldn't be able to hold the suspense. And he doesn't dwell on things because he knows time is running out. He goes there, on the beach, we identify with one of the guys. He's nameless at first. He's the only survivor. All the others are shot by German snipers. And then he's suddenly on the beach and he wants to go home. And there are people queuing up for boats and ships that are not yet there. I think those initial images on the beach are very, very strong. Just people lining up on the beach for something that is not yet there.
Yeah, it's a very English kind of thing, though, a movie about queuing. But yeah, no, I know what you mean.
Yeah, yes. I have to say, I had a slight problem the first 10 minutes because I realized I didn't know what Harry Styles looked like. That wasn't so much of a problem because every soldier is basically has black hair, slightly disheveled, wind-shaved skin, gaunt. They don't talk much. They're hungry. They're just waiting, they're desperate, and I realized, okay, any one of those guys could be Harry Styles, you know.
Yeah.
I really don't care who he is.
That's true. I mean, I remember at the beginning, it almost irritated me a bit that I had no idea who was who. It was almost like, you know, an HBO series where you feel you have to take 3 episodes just to learn the names. But then I realize it doesn't matter. There are some story strands where it does matter. And there you've got, I don't know, Cillian Murphy, you've got Tom Hardy, and you recognize these guys. But the people on the beach, I think part of it is, as you say, there's 400,000 of them. And this is, in a way, the story of each and every one of them.
True, yeah. I mean, Nolan was never really big on characterization. The only exception I can remember is Memento, where he focuses on one guy and on two or three side characters. There we have a lot of characterization. We get to know these people. In all the other movies, the Batman trilogy, Insomnia, it's sort of... we get to know sort of... we get to know Bruce Wayne, but we've known him before. There is no need for big characterization. That doesn't mean he doesn't have that. I think he does, but not in the way that people in Memento have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's actually something I've missed. My very first Christopher Nolan movie was Memento, and that one at the time blew me away. In the meantime, I think it's got certain flaws, but it's still probably my favourite Nolan film because it has an intimacy that, as you say, the Batman movies don't have. Inception, it rarely has it. Interstellar also rarely has it. They're much bigger films, and I think while Dunkirk is also a big film, it still has an intimacy that the other films don't have.
That's true, yeah. I was completely fine. I think he has that lack of characterization he has turned into a strength. In movies like Dunkirk, it's an advantage. You can hop from one character to the next, always with a good reason, but you can. He intercuts scenes with those, with the Harry Styles group, with scenes on those requisitioned boats, with the Mark Rylance character and the Cillian Murphy character. I think it works perfectly because there's always time running out, TikTok. And I think large parts of the soundtrack even have
a ticking clock. Yeah, you're right. It's a bit like Atonement, where you've got the typewriter, and this one it's the ticking clock.
That's true. Yeah, yeah. And I think it's sort of sometimes he lets the musical score be and has another scene of absolute silence. For instance, when those guys go into the belly of that boat on the beach and they wait for the water to carry the boat away, they quarrel because they think there might be a traitor in their midst, but half of the time, not a word is spoken. They just wait. Those are fantastic. And then you know that afterwards there will be another, you know, the whole movie is some sort of upwards pointing sinus curve. It's quite cleverly done. I wanted the guys to survive. I knew not everyone would survive. And he doesn't work towards some great climax. There is a very small scene where Kenneth Branagh thinks that a German fighter plane would shoot specifically him on the beach, and that doesn't happen. So it's some sort of anticlimax, if at all. But oftentimes the movie doesn't focus very long on single dramatic events. It's like that big boat that wants to carry the people away. I think it's some kind of Red Cross boat, if I remember correctly. The German planes shoot at it, it sinks. If it sinks at the pier, the whole Dunkirk Enterprise will be lost. And Ken Branagh says, get that boat away from the pier, otherwise the whole British army that's here in Dunkirk will be lost. Mm-hmm. And then another movie would have a 15-minute, 20-minute sequence where soldiers, maybe tuck at the ports with their bare hands to move the sinking boat away from the pier, and they just make it in time. Dunkirk doesn't do that. The boat sort of floats away from the pier. Probably take 60 seconds, 90 seconds, and you know, okay, the whole enterprise is still possible, let's go on. And that's it. The movie does something else afterwards. It's not a 20-minute sequence, yes or no. It does well, because it never gets the whole process out of its sight. And I sort of admired that, you know. Mm-hmm. Michael Bay would make a whole spectacle of the whole thing.
Exactly, and there will probably be Transformers involved, kind of German Nazi Transformers and, you know, the good English and American Transformers. I don't think I would want to watch that film, yeah. But you're right, it doesn't insist on things, except when there's moments when insisting on things makes sense, when they're in the belly of the boat, when suddenly water starts streaming in. But it is quite willing to cut away from things, and that is rare. That's rare, especially in this day and age where big movies tend to be epic movies, and that also means that so many movies tend to be longer than they need to be.
True, yeah. There are rumors that Nolan, in a very early stage of planning the movie, he wanted to film Dunkirk without any kind of screenplay. I mean, I didn't get any details, but how do you film a historical event without a screenplay? You have it in your mind and you go from day to day. I have no idea. I mean, there's not a whole lot room for improvisation, because the focus groups or the historians, they might block you apart if you veer off from, too much from what is known about Dunkirk.
Exactly. Although I would be kind of interested in seeing Mike Lee's Dunkirk.
It's possible, yeah. Mike Lee's Dunkirk, I would watch that.
With Jim Broadbent and probably someone like Eddie Marzan, yeah, absolutely, I'd be there.
Did it bother you that the movie is not strictly chronological?
No, I liked it. I wasn't clear at first at what it was doing. And then after a while, I started realizing, okay, 1 week, 1 day, 1 hour. I started realizing how it comes together. And that, I think, it ties in with what you said about the upwards curve of the tension and the clock kind of ticking faster and faster. It basically all aims towards the same moment, the moment when basically, a spoiler for those who don't know history, when all the English ships and boats come to basically get people and evacuate them from the beach. I think it does that very well. It's confusing at first, but I think the confusion also pulls you in more, because you're trying to find out, okay, what is it doing? How are these stories connected? Haven't we seen this before from a different angle? And I think that was actually very effective.
Yeah. I didn't think it was adding anything significant to the storytelling. It might have been just chronological, if you ask me. But I can see how that might improve the viewing experience for some viewers. It didn't do anything for me, but it was confusing. I really tried to be very attentive, and somehow I sort of lost the plot at some point. Then I realized, oh, all right, we've seen that before. They are already in the boat. It's not new. It has happened before.
Yeah, I think if it had been chronological, it would have probably. I don't know. What I like is that basically we get three very different experiences, and each experience is kind of given the same importance. There's the experience of waiting and hoping and dreading what will happen. The guy on the beach who basically has almost no control over his fate whatsoever. You've got Tom Hardy in a Spitfire. That's more kind of conventional heroism. You know, he's there to shoot down the Germans who want to basically bombard the boats. So you've got almost the kind of classical war movie heroism. And then you've got, you know, the boats, the more quiet civilian heroism of Mark Rylance. They're going there to save people, not to shoot anyone down, not to fight the German army, but to kind of save and salvage. And by intercutting them, I think you're not prioritizing or privileging one kind of story over the other. All of these stories kind of make up the whole thing. I think that might be lost a bit if you had it chronologically. One thing I wanted to ask you was, I mean, we've had lots of war films that were pretty violent, pretty bloody. I mean, the traditional example of that is probably Saving Private Ryan, where the first 10-15 minutes are really extremely gruesome. Realistically, possibly, but really gruesome. You had something like Hacksaw Ridge recently, which I think was also very, very violent, graphically so. And then you've got Dunkirk, where I think you see very little blood, you don't see any limbs blown off. How did you react to that? Did you find that it kind of sanitized warfare, or did you find it effective?
I thought that was really very effective. I think Nolan is very, very color conscious. There are many muted colors. There is the blue of the sea, the gray of the sky. It's an overcast day. Most colors are toned down, muted. There is some blood in the movie, but it's very sparse. It's every time we see blood, I think it's almost dried already. So we don't see any fresh blood, any fresh wound. Too much blood would have looked obscene with all of that blue and gray. Because I remember when the soldiers go into that large boat where they get breakfast. They all have toast in their hands, buttered toast with red marmalade. It's probably raspberry or whatever. And it looks wrong. It looks wrong in a movie that relies on its grays and its blues and on its black hair and on the gray of the ships and on the fair brown of the sand on the beach. It looks wrong. Too much blood would have, oh, it sounds like a very artistic thing to say, but it would have spoiled the color scheme. It wouldn't have fit. Yeah, I know. Of course, there was must have been a whole lot of blood. Many, many people didn't survive. There must have been just as many dead bodies and limbs like there were in on D-Day. Of course, I know that, but it doesn't have to be in the movie. We already know that, and it would have charred with the general atmosphere of Dunkirk specifically, I think. You don't have to go all out with the violence in order to show that there was violence. I mean, in Dunkirk, there are bodies on the beach. I think they're covered or already in body bags, if such a thing existed way back then. It's enough. I mean, the sand is blowing over those dead bodies. That's a much stronger image than any kind of red or any kind of limb.
I mean, the one scene where I thought that was probably most clearly visible for me was one very, very early on when basically one of the leads just turns up on the beach, and then I think two or three German planes, basically they fly towards the beach and they drop their bombs. And you basically, everyone basically gets down on the ground, puts their arms over their heads and hopes that they won't be hit by a bomb. And you see basically this line of explosions coming down the beach towards our protagonist, basically. But you see lots of other people there on the beach as well. Many of them are hit. You don't need to see limbs flying to know exactly what is happening to them. And you also don't need to see that kind of gore and blood and guts and bits in order to know that this guy basically thinks, okay, that's it, the next bomb is going to get him. It wouldn't make it more effective, it wouldn't make it more frightening, or it wouldn't make it easier for us to identify with him. It would just, I think, I agree with you, we've seen that, there was a reason for it. There's, you know, there's, for instance, TV series like HBO's The Pacific, which are very violent, very graphically violent, but the violence almost gets, I don't know, there's an almost surreal element to it. It's just so outlandish, and, you know, you can use that as a stylistic measure. But I think in Dunkirk, as you say, it was absolutely right not to focus on that, not to insist on that. It wouldn't have added anything to this particular film and to Christopher Nolan's storytelling.
Yeah, it was slightly spooky because there was a trailer for Darkest Hour, just for Dunkirk. And Darkest Hour, of course, features the Churchill and his speech. We shall fight them on the beaches, in the streets, and on the hills. We shall never surrender. And that's exactly, those are exactly the words that one of the young soldiers reads from the newspaper, stumbling over his own words. You know, the same words rendered in a completely different context, in a completely different tone of voice. It was spooky. There's that polished Churchill speech, Churchill played by Gary Oldman, and then you have that newspaper article in the end. It sort of improved Dunkirk without it. Of course, it didn't do it on purpose at all, but I was sort of, yeah, okay. The speech at the end of Dunkirk is sort of more effective because it's uttered by some sort of shell-shocked youngster, you know, who 10 minutes ago didn't know whether the general population would celebrate him as a hero or denounce him as a traitor, you know.
Yeah, I agree, that was definitely effective, but I think the ending is also where I have to admit I had a bit of a problem with Dunkirk. Basically, I think the film ends on a note of what I would call kind of very British sentimentality. I think the Brits have that. It's not the kind of loud violins and, you know, tears everywhere sentimentality, but I think there is this kind of, you know, we are British, we have a stiff upper lip, you know, keep calm and carry on, feeling that, you know, we didn't ask for this, but we're quietly, with quiet resolve, basically being heroes and saviors, where Brits cannot be bad guys. Brits are really ambivalent. There's some of that in the film. I think, you know, the film shows that these guys, they're not all good guys. They're not all heroes. They can be cowards, and it's normal to be cowardly under those situations. But I think in the end, it does go a bit too much in the direction of a kind of sentimentality that I think would be okay if I hadn't seen it a dozen times already. And I have to say that Nolan, it's weird, at the beginning of his career, I thought basically Nolan is a very cerebral filmmaker. He makes films that are a bit cold, almost, but in an effective way. He doesn't dwell much on emotion, but emotion comes in through the back door. Problem is, in his last couple of films, I think especially Interstellar, but also Dunkirk to some extent, it feels like he's getting sentimental as he's getting older, and I'm not sure the kind of slightly Spielbergian touches suit his filmmaking that well for me.
I didn't find the ending too sentimental. There was sentimentality, yeah. But it, well, if he had cranked up the sentimentality, it would have bothered me. But that way, no.
I mean, it definitely bothered me much, much less than it did in Interstellar. I think Interstellar, by comparison, it also spells out the sentimentality. It basically has an entire badly written speech about love and everything. And this film, I agree, it's I think it wouldn't have bothered me if I hadn't felt that I've seen it too often before. And even like that, you know, it didn't ruin the film for me, but it basically meant that I felt the ending was the weakest part of the film, where everything that comes before is stronger. But even like that, you know, I think it's definitely a very strong film. It's probably, I would say, to my mind, it's Nolan's best in quite a while.
Agreed, yeah. I find something good in every of his movies, but that one has some very good scenes for a very long stretch of the time, yeah.
I mean, I said at the beginning, for me, probably Memento is my favourite Nolan film. Do you have a favourite Nolan film?
Oh, I think that's also Memento. Because no one else ever told a story that way ever before. Plus, it was very well done. It was some sort of backwards mystery. Now it left me stunned. I was mesmerized, really.
Yeah, no, it also, I think Memento has a kind of weird, sardonic sense of humor that I think Nolan, he's not a comic filmmaker. He's definitely not someone who tells jokes in his films. But I think his films work best when the slightly ponderous quality of what I call cerebral, you know, his films can have something quite heavy at times. If that is alleviated a bit by characters who can, you know, make quips, not in a Joss Whedon sense, that would be completely wrong in this universe, but I think his films they carry a whole lot of seriousness. And, you know, with Dunkirk, I think I accept that best, you know, it's the story that it's telling. But I think his other films, they do benefit from a certain weird, unexpected sense of humour every now and then, and I think Memento definitely still has that. When Christopher Nolan doesn't yet know that he's Christopher Nolan, who basically carries the weight of, you know, having to make his studio millions and millions of dollars.
Save DC Comics from mediocre adaptations or something. You know?
Yeah, although, I mean, with Wonder Woman, I think they have definitely shown that there is potential there.
There is. There very much is. I think Patty Jenkins signed on to Wonder Woman 2, I hear. So
okay, that's good to hear. Yeah. So from one war to another war, from grey, desperate men on a beach to Wonder Woman.
Full circle, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think that probably just about wraps it up for this episode. It's been very enjoyable talking to you about Dunkirk, as always. And I'm already looking forward to next month's conversation. I have no idea yet what we'll bring to the table, but I'm sure it will be interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you to all our listeners. I'll again remind you that A Damn Fine Cup of Culture is brought to you by Eagles on Pogo Sticks. If you have any feedback, whether it's good, bad, or just weird, you know, feel free to send it to us at Eagles on Pogo Sticks. We will see you or hear you or speak to you again in a month's time. Bye.
Goodbye.